welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a drug czar conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Drug czar, as in the informal title for the person who oversees drug control policies. I personally don't like the word czar because of the association with the horrid Russian leaders who decreed pogroms against the Jews and other bad things. But hey, language changes, and today, American czars don't have that evil association. The first U.S. drug czar was Harry Anslinger, who served as the first commissioner to the Treasury Department's Federal Bureau of Narcotics from 1930 to 1962, under Hoover, Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy. He pushed for the Uniform State Narcotic Drug Act and Marijuana Tax Act of 1937. Harry had quite a long run, and I think that he may be rolling in his grave if he saw what was happening today with drug legalization, normalization, and commercialization. The drug czar position has evolved through different federal agencies, and in 1988, the position became what we know today as a director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, or ONDCP. I tried to meet all the living drug czars, a few of which have become my mentors. Today, I have the great opportunity and privilege to meet yet another U.S. drug czar. To learn more about drug czars, I reached out to Gil Kerlikowski. Gil Kerlikowski began his career in law enforcement in St. Petersburg, Florida, and then chief of police in Seattle. He served the Obama administration for 5 years as director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, ONDCP, and he then served as the Senate-confirmed commissioner of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency, CBP, also under President Obama. To learn more about Gil Kerlikowski, check out the High Truths show notes. Gil Kerlikowski, welcome to High Truths.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm really delighted and excited. I've been waiting for this opportunity to learn so much from you. You have such a historical perspective and in a position that's very relevant to what's happening in our country today. And let's start with your background or even your name, Gil Kerlikowski. That's unusual. Gil, I think, means happy in so many different languages.
Well, it was also my dad's name. So his was Richard Gil Kerlikowski, and that was mine. So he always went by Dick. I always went by my middle name, Gil. And you don't hear it as much anymore, but it's been a sense of joy with that name.
Yes. And your path to become our nation's drug czar under President Obama, tell us how that evolved.
Well, I'd been the police chief for almost 9 years in Seattle, and kind of the lifespan, and I know you're in San Diego area. I mean, the lifespan of a police chief in a big city is usually 3 or 4 years. So 9 years was quite a while. Shortly after the election in November of 08, Vice President Biden's office called and said, would you be interested in being President Obama's drug policy advisor? And I thought about that. I went home and I told my wife, you'll never guess who called today and talking about this. And she said, that's great. That's interesting. Don't forget to take out the garbage tonight. So she kind of put things in perspective. But it came about, and I was nominated in March of 2009, and I was confirmed in May, which is pretty unheard of today, going through confirmation that quickly and with so little concern by either side of the aisle.
That's great. And, oh, I forgot, but I do want to give a special shout out to the people who connected us, which is Janet Rouse. I think you know her, and Mary Bono. And then I was talking to Paul Larkin and said that I was going to have you on the program, and he sends his special regards to you as well.
Well, that's great. And Paul did such great work on drugged driving. I mean, he's really known for looking at some of the negative aspects, particularly of marijuana and drivers under the influence.
Yes. And he speaks highly of you as, again, one of the leading and still, even though it's been a while, authorities on the issue of drugs. Now, so you became the drug czar. It's kind of like a Russian word for the head of an agency. Do you like that title?
Not particularly, but it's been around a long time. My wife, though, liked being called the Tsarina. So.
Oh, that's adorable.
I guess that all works out, but it's been there for a long time since Bill Bennett was the first director of that office, and it's had a wide array of people from different backgrounds and experiences who have headed that office. So it was a great opportunity and really a terrific 5 years.
And when you came into office, did you learn from previous drug czars before you and got advice from them?
Yeah, I met with every one of them. I met with Bill Bennett. I met with Bob Martinez, who'd been the governor of Florida. On and on. General McCaffrey was tremendously helpful. Lee Brown, who'd been a police chief in New York City, was the mayor, and later on went on to be the mayor of Houston. They all had different perspectives, and they were all incredibly, whoever appointed them from whatever party, they were all just incredibly helpful and wanted to see the office and our issues involving drugs, that we'd all have more success. So it truly is an area that crosses all the party lines.
And did you get any, does any advice kind of stand out, like that you appreciate receiving?
Well, I think it was so interesting to be able to get the different perspectives. Bob Martinez had been a governor. General McCaffrey was the youngest four-star general in the history of the Army. And so they had different perspectives. I knew the law enforcement end very well, but I really didn't understand and have good knowledge of substance abuse disorders, disease, treatment, prevention, and of course, recovery. So I learned a lot, but the office is also staffed with a number of incredibly talented, terrific people.
Yeah. And when you were in office, you were, it was also a cabinet level position. You met with the president.
You know, it was not, it was cabinet level, but it was, a cabinet office under different presidents, President Bush, et cetera. But when Bill Bennett was appointed and President Reagan appointed him, it was not a cabinet office. It was cabinet level. So you're right there. And that distinction comes up quite a bit.
Can you explain to us the difference?
Yeah, it's meaningless. that's the easy explanation. You can be a member of the president's cabinet, and attend the cabinet meetings, and you can also be at a cabinet level position, so you're not attending those meetings, not having some of the regular meetings with the president in the cabinet room. And I think that's perfectly fine. Bill Bennett told me that he said, look, as long as you have access and communication, you really don't have to worry about being a member of the cabinet. He said, I was a cabinet member as Secretary of Education. He said, it's not that big a deal.
Right. And you had access.
Yeah, the communication was much more with the vice president's office because he'd been involved early on in the formation of ONDCP, Office of National Drug Control Policy. So, and at that time, when President Obama took office, you know, the issues in front of the country right then were economic, employment issues and monetary issues. And that was the focus. So, you know, as the drug policy director, I actually got to make a lot of decisions and take us where I thought we should be going without having a lot of people from the White House calling and saying, oh, no, you know, you should do this or you should do that. So in some ways, not having a huge amount of access was beneficial.
Interesting. So, like you mentioned, there have been several different people with different professions who've been the drug czar. You mentioned general law enforcement, mayors. Now we have a doctor. Do you think that it matters, the background?
You know, I think if you're willing to understand the complexity of the problem and the breadth and the scope of the problem, and you're able to recognize that, and you don't come across as, well, you know, here's how we're going to fix it. If we do more security at the border, it'll be better. If we work more closely in the Southern Hemisphere, it'll be better. If you want to look at different treatment and prevention programs, you know, you have to realize that that there are a lot of different tools in the toolbox. And if you're the director, you have to be open to looking at them.
Yeah. We say it's a three-legged stool, right? You can't have, you know, without the reducing supply, treatment and prevention. It's multifactorial.
It is. And I think we also ended up trying to have a fourth leg to that stool, and that was recovery. We really didn't have an appreciation for the number of people in recovery. And there were so many rumors abounding that if a person had become addicted to methamphetamine, they could never recover. You know, they'd always be addicted and on and on. And yet, you know, throughout the country, I mean, I met hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who had their lives back, who were in recovery, who were doing very well. So I think we tried to make it a fourth leg of the stool.
That's nice. I think we've kind of lost that, but that is very important with the, you know, over 20 million people who are living in recovery. They are proof that that treatment is possible and getting better is possible.
Yes.
Looking back at your time, 5 years, what's your proudest accomplishment of the things that you did? And one of them, as you said, is bringing the whole recovery community together.
Well, there are a couple things I think that were important. One is that you can't turn to any certain page in the federal budget and say, gee, how much money are we spending on drug prevention, drug treatment, drug enforcement, et cetera. It is in every, you know, the Department of Defense, the Department of Justice, Health and Human Services. And that was the whole purpose of actually the formation of ONDCP, is to bring all of that together under kind of one umbrella, not to direct and order, but to bring people together to collaborate, to work together, and to have one policy, the president's drug policy, that everyone could buy into, commit time and resources to. And I think that was really helpful. We brought a number of people to the table that had been left out for quite a while. So developing that with their collaboration and input, I think was very helpful.
Yeah, and you know what, Gil, that lasted to this day. To this day, we have it like measured to the penny who gets what dollars. I didn't realize that you're the one who started that. That's amazing.
Well, it kind of, during the Bush administration, it wasn't quite as collaborative, perhaps. And, you know, these cabinet level officials have their own budgets, their own issues. You know, they're pretty busy themselves. And to say, okay, you really need to take the time to help us develop the president's national drug control strategy, and then you need to be able to commit resources, when in fact they've all got, you know, their own issues that they're dealing with. But, you know, we're, you know, to use a kind of a worn phrase, we really are stronger together on this.
Yeah. And I don't know if you're like me, but like, you know, when I went to ONDCP, I had a list of things that I really wanted to accomplish. And I didn't. I accomplished some things that weren't on my list, but there were some things I really wanted to get done. Do you have any things that you wished or you wanted to get done but didn't quite happen?
Absolutely. And it didn't happen. And I really looked a lot at prevention. And I thought that the Department of Education should commit significant resources. They have expertise. They have people that can work on this and develop a really comprehensive prevention program that would be age and grade specific, that could be tied to a healthcare curriculum. And you could start as early as first grade, and you could go all the way through high school with kids, and so that that they would have something to help them understand the dangers. And it isn't, of course, just the dangers of drugs. Now we see the dangers of vaping and the problems associated with that, alcohol. And as Regina LaBelle from Georgetown said the other day, you know, we also are not really recognizing the potential now that we can gamble using our iPhones or cell phones, and the gambling problem that's coming up. So we have I really would have liked the Department of Education to do that. Unfortunately, they were concentrating on violence in and around schools. At that time, the number of school shootings, et cetera, was something that they were putting a lot of time and attention to. So I still think that prevention is something that that should really, really get a boost in any administration.
You know what? It's probably short-sighted of the Department of Education at the time when violence was a thing to not go back, because the whole issue of drugs, violence, bullying, all have a common core of, you know, resiliency and dealing with life's adversities without resulting going to drugs or anything else. And you're right, that starts in preschool, right? When my granddaughter, you know, in her little preschool scout, there's a little sign that says, if you get frustrated, these are the things that you can do, right? And that's drug prevention education. You know, like, it teaches you that there, you know, you have struggles, but there are other ways of coping with them. And there are evidence-based programs, and they are implemented in some communities. I'm really proud of our local district attorney, Summer Steffen, for bringing that program to San Diego. And it's voluntary now. But if we had the Department of Education, like you said, like you tried to do in your time, that's a good one. Isn't it funny how sometimes in life, when you look back at some things that you couldn't accomplish and it was years ago, they're still relevant today.
You're right. And I'm hoping that, and I think it's been good to have Dr. Gupta there, the first physician to head up that office also. But I think it's going to be important in the future, because people keep saying, well, if you just seize more drugs at the border, if you confiscate more drugs, that we'll have less of a problem. And the analogy that Professor Calkins, I think, gave me was that it's kind of like if you want to eliminate all the diamonds in America, seize all the lumps of coal.
Yeah, we have had other people who were headed the, it wasn't called ONDCP right before, it had different names, but Dr. Jerome Jaffe did that under President Nixon, and I know he was a great mentor to me as well. So you were mentioning that politics don't really have a place in drugs, and I always thought that until maybe recently, because we just want people to be healthier. We want, you know, children to grow up to their full potential. And who's against that? And now I don't know if things have evolved. Do you still think that it's an apolitical issue? even when we have debates on marijuana, debates on what does harm reduction mean, debates on the proportion on the application. Like, I think that right now we're allocating money incorrectly. Like, too much is going to harm reduction at the cost of prevention. There's a political component in that. And I want to know if you've seen that change, or is it really an apolitical or non-political issue?
Well, I think the debate has been going on many, many, many years. And there are a number of people that will dissect the federal budget and show how much is going to enforcement and how much is going to prevention and how much is going to treatment. And then they'll always come back with, well, more money should be going here, more money should be going there. So I don't see it as much as a political issue. And in fact, even during this campaign season, the drug issue, other than fentanyl, the drug issue really isn't getting much discussion at all. And you've seen
a shame, right? It's a shame. It's our number one killer.
and President Trump has said, look, he's going to support marijuana if it becomes a Schedule 3 instead of a Schedule 1. He is supportive of that. I think marijuana is still a significant problem in the country. The THC levels are very high. The number of people that are driving under the influence of marijuana. So I don't see it as much as a political issue as it is among the different people that have kind of a stake in either in any side, enforcement, prevention, treatment, et cetera.
I have to look up. I didn't hear that President Trump supports the rescheduling. I heard that he supports legalizing, but with regulations, such as he doesn't want smoke everywhere.
Yeah, I think that it was interesting because I was there when Colorado and Washington had their referendum. It was really well supported, a lot of ads, very, very, and I lived in Seattle for a long time. A lot of money was spent on that. And it was interesting because you had people saying, well, then if marijuana becomes legal, it can be taxed, you can have tax money, it'll be controlled, it'll be regulated.
They were following the money instead of following the public health.
Right. And then, of course, you know, what we found is that it's kind of like George H.W. Bush once said, nothing's ever as bad as it seems and nothing's ever as good as it seems. So it really didn't knock out the black market. At all, and the amount of tax dollars, they say, well, Colorado, it was very smart to say we'll use those tax dollars to improve schools, the infrastructure of schools. Yeah. You know, but what they don't count is the number of fatal and non-fatal accidents, the number of kids eating edible, you know, grabbing edible marijuana by mistake and being taken to the emergency department. All those are costs to society, and they're costs out of the taxpayers. And so to say, look how much money we got from taxes, I think is unbelievably short-sighted.
Interesting that you say that. So let's continue our discussion with marijuana. You were there, you kind of like, you know, saw the problem happening, you know, and now it's kind of like a little bit of I told you so, but it's out there. I don't think even voters at the time realized all the new products and the genetic alterations that happened to the marijuana when people voted for it. And then they still, even here in California, say, well, you know, this is what the voters wanted. It's like, no, I don't think the voters wanted shatters and dabs with 98% THC that are causing psychosis in children, or just like you said, the number one poisoning in the country now are children under the age of 5. These are not, you know, little babies laughing or trying to get high. They're encephalopathic or in the ICU or even on a ventilator. We've dropped the ball.
Well, I think that it started when General McCaffrey was at ONDCP and went to California when California said, let's have medical marijuana. And he said, you know, this is nothing but a sham. basically, and it is a way to start the process of legalization by calling it a medicine. And as you well know, as a doctor, we don't take medicines that are not approved by the FDA.
There you go. Oh, my God. I love you, Gil.
Here we go. And so General McCaffrey was just, they went up one side and down the other saying, oh, you know, don't you want to help people going through chemotherapy? Don't you want to help people with glaucoma? And medical marijuana will be such a help. Well, we have Marinol, you know, and it is like the least prescribed drug in the country. And now, of course, we have a lot of other real pharmaceuticals to deal with the impacts of chemotherapy or glaucoma. So that was, I mean, he saw that for what it was. I always appreciate Governor Jerry Brown, and when they asked him about legalization. And he said, do we really need one more mind-altering substance?
And the answer is no, we need a whole bunch because now they're legalizing all the psychedelics and the hemp products and all sorts of other things. So not just one. So maybe we need several. I'm really surprised that my own profession that didn't push back a lot more. Because if you think of what I have to do to have my medical license, the education that I need, the continuing medical education, before I prescribe or recommend any treatment, there has to be a cost-benefit analysis, documentation. None of that applies to medical marijuana. So it is a sham.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting too is because it's not a bunch of old people my age wearing tie-dye t-shirts and wanting to have a little marijuana off, you know, where they can sell, et cetera. It is all like big tobacco. It's all big business. Yeah, filled with lawyers. And when it becomes, if it becomes, and I think it will, a Schedule 3, they'll be able to write off all their expenses because as a Schedule 1, you know, they can't deduct their expenses. As a Schedule 3, all of these costs can be deducted. And someone once told me
it's worse. They want insurance to pay for your medical, quote unquote, medical marijuana.
Well, and someone, you know, they talked to me about, once it becomes Schedule 3, a lot more research can be done. So I met with a number of pharmaceutical, big pharma in companies, and they said, they explained it pretty clearly. It costs $1 billion to develop a drug and bring it to market, $1 billion. If we don't have something like Viagra or something else where we're going to make our money back, do you really think we're going to invest that kind of time in a plant and doing research on marijuana? Because they wouldn't get their money back.
But that's to go through the FDA process to get right. The whole point of using it and calling it medical marijuana is to skirt the FDA process, which is the gold standard. That's my problem with the whole rescheduling is right now, whether you like or don't like the FDA, there are gold standard for our society for medications. And if we skirt that process, it destroys my profession. Like, why go to a doctor?
Right. And as you know, we're one of only two countries where we advertise all our medicines on. And then people like you, you know, I'll come to see you and say, oh, I saw this advertisement for this drug. And are you going to put me on this, et cetera, when I should be depending on you rather than a television commercial for what drug I should be asking for?
Right. Yeah, but nowadays it's Ozempa, right? It's a cure-all for everything, the drug that people want to be on, which brings us to China, because they're making that because there's a demand. Whenever we have a demand in the United States, China knows how to fill it, right? Whether it's fentanyl or Ozempa, and then it causes a lot of health problems here. Fentanyl wasn't a thing in your days, and now it's the biggest problem. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that China did take a number of steps now to limit production of fentanyl from China. Difficulty, of course, are the precursor chemicals that are sent oftentimes then to Mexico where the fentanyl is made. And it's such a powerful drug, and it takes so little to actually make money that it's, you know, that the precursors, of course, can come from India. They can come from Bangladesh. They can come from Germany. You know, and I've even seen where some of the precursors are sent to the United States, and because there are other uses for some of these. And then illegally, some people will send those to Mexico. And it looks like it's much safer because, wow, this is coming from the United States. So no, fentanyl is, being able to detect it, I think Customs and Border Protection went from, in 2000, just a couple of years ago, went from 5,000 pounds of fentanyl seizures to 27,000 pounds in like 3 years. So it really does tell you something about our ports of entry and how that drug is getting here to the United States.
Wow. So do agree that I do want to get into the border because I know that you have a lot of experience with that and that it's relevant to our discussion. But with fentanyl, do you I work with families against fentanyl, trying to declare fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction in order to get a government approach to suppressing that. You know, for example, that what you're saying, you know, China is making efforts. It's a whack-a-mole efforts. The things that we've declared, the precursors we've declared illegal here are still legal in China. So when they all say, okay, well, please make this illegal, they'll say, okay, but there's 16 other precursors that we, you know, they're are legal to us, but legal in their country. And it's just, you know, the production for our demand continues.
Yeah, I've read pieces on that on kind of both sides, and I'm not so sure that there's a particularly, as we all want in this country, we always want simple answers. We end up living in a world of ambiguity, unfortunately, and so I don't really know enough about it to opine on whether that would be helpful or not. But I do think going back to prevention. I mean, these kids are looking at these little pills, as the AP reported yesterday and others, the number of pill presses, and they think they're buying something that is a legitimate pharmaceutical, albeit a painkiller. And it turns out to be just a counterfeit fentanyl, 30 milligram.
Right. And I don't know if it existed so much in your time. The pressure, there's actually a counter pressure. Like we always want, you said, we want education, teaching resiliency, teaching the danger, teaching really to protect your brain, not even a negative. This is a future you want for yourself. But on the other hand, there are billboards everywhere, again, about marijuana, about psychedelics, about other things that are being pushed on our society. So we're fighting that as well. It makes it harder. I don't know if you agree that times have changed a little bit.
Well, I mean, I remember going to Florida a lot, and that was on the prescription opioids. And when I went down to Broward County along I-95, there was a really aggressive television reporter that really broke that story of pain clinics and how they were being used. But you'd see a billboard, and you remember these old commercials, Got Milk? Well, they on the billboard, it would say got pain, and you'd go into a drive-by, you'd get an MRI, and you'd walk around the corner to another drive-by, and there would be a physician writing, you know, prescriptions.
With a long line of people behind them.
Exactly. That's right. And, you know, when you looked at where the prescription drug problem was, Eastern Kentucky, West Virginia, southern tier of Ohio, it wasn't exactly in big media markets. So if you had that number of people becoming addicted, dying, et cetera, in New York City or Chicago or Washington, it would have gotten a lot of media attention. But because it was Appalachia, it wasn't getting the kind of national attention that prescription drugs should have gotten early on.
Yeah, and so let's talk about the border since we mentioned that we have a lot of experience. Your time as commissioner of the Customs and Border Patrol. Should we have open borders Do we have open borders right now?
No, I mean, we can't have open borders. And it's a problem that has existed for well over three decades. Every president has had people coming through. The last year, 2023, was particularly high, 2.5 million. But the last year of President Trump was almost a million people. President Bush, President Clinton, et cetera. We have had, and of course, now it's a little bit different because America is a destination for the world. When I was there, Mexico was not as much of an issue, people from Mexico, because safety, security, education, it was, and the economy, it was better. And they weren't willing, they didn't want to flee Mexico. But the three Central American countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, that was where people were coming from and making a very dangerous trek. But now it's Haiti, Venezuela, Ecuador, China, Russia, et cetera. People flying into Nicaragua because you can fly to Nicaragua without any paperwork. And then they know that they'll be making their way through Mexico and into the United States, which is a destination for people around the world.
Right. But that's always been the case, right? America's always had been the dream.
Well, I think that if you look at all the buildings that were built, particularly like during the Bush administration and others, the Border Patrol stations were all pretty much designed for the problem that they were dealing with. Single adult males from Mexico who weren't particularly interested in staying in the United States, but they wanted to come in, work, and send money back home. But then when the unaccompanied children and the people from the three Central American countries that I mentioned, none of these facilities were built to house families, to house children. And of course, that was the summer I started. We had 68,000 unaccompanied children across the border. But again, it was only the three Central American countries that were the primary problem. Now, you know, Venezuela, all these other countries, there's just a lot of people trying to get into the United States from around the world.
So if you were the border czar right now, what needs to happen?
Well, one, I'd build facilities that are much more able to house people. We found success. And we rented and bought facilities while I was there and converted them. We found success that if people came across the border, they were detained and they could get a hearing. If they ended up back in their home country, in their village, 3 or 4 or 5 months after getting to the United States, after spending a lot of money, usually village money and relatives' money, if they were back in their home village 3 or 4 or 5 months later, it sent a powerful message that, yes, I made it to the United States. And now, because to reach a claim of asylum is very difficult, very, very, you know, it's, I think it's less than 30% of the people that claim asylum ever reach that threshold. So I would build some facilities where people can actually be detained once they cross the border rather than sent to other places in the country and told, come back in 5 years for a hearing.
Or how about the prevention approach, like stay in Mexico in your country and then come for your hearing or, you know, yeah.
The Remain in Mexico policy of President Trump was one that a number of people on both sides of the aisle thought was pretty workable. It was a pretty viable solution. And it's almost like going down the freeway, a busy freeway like in San Diego, and you have the red light and the green light, you know, and the traffic people going, you know, getting into the traffic flow. And of course, you need the full cooperation of Mexico. And I really don't think that President Lopez Obrador is a particularly good friend or supportive of the United States. The difficulty with Remain in Mexico was that it was so incredibly painful looking. There were no resources, no healthcare issues, education, housing, on and on. And so they, you know, I think the thinking among Trump officials was that, well, this will be so miserable that when they're waiting there month after month after month, that they'll end up going back home. Problem was that going back home was as bad or worse as what they were enduring in Mexico. But I think that if you had remained in Mexico and you had safety, security, healthcare, some education, and you could actually then stagger people making an application, I think remain in Mexico is not the worst policy.
That's great to hear that. I like to hear that, especially to have policies be judged as they stand alone, not necessarily by who they came from, right? Because I saw a lot of President Trump's policies just completely erased just because he's the one who wrote them. So it's like
it is interesting, isn't it, what happens? Because when we were leaving office, you know, the President Obama had made it clear, like, look, I want you to give all the information. And we prepared briefing books. We prepared all kinds of things about customs and border protection. I mean, it's 60,000 people. It touches every aspect of our economy, our travel, our tourism, and our border security. And so we said, here we are. We've got all this. We'd like to sit down and tell you what we did, what worked, what didn't work, what we foresee. And the incoming administration said, we have no interest in meeting with you. We'll do what we want.
That's just silly.
And I thought every time that happens on whatever administration, I think you lose a lot of value.
Yes. One topic that was really touched me because I, you know, worked on it is removing the X waiver to allow prescribing Suboxone to people. And, you know, the office and in general, the administration was against it. Then COVID hit, which was an opportunity. It's like, really, do you want me to take an 8-hour education before I treat COVID? Do you want, you know, this is not how we practice medicine. I don't need 8 hours to prescribe morphine. Why do I need 8 hours to prescribe something to counter that? And President Trump was able to do it. And as soon as the administration, like the egos involved in here are like amazing. They're like, oh, no, Trump did this. We have to get rid of it. He did it wrong. And it was 3 years. I mean, how many people died in 3 years before they, you know, Congress reinstated the X waiver? So, yeah, some of that petty, I guess, I don't know, ego is what I could think of. And like you mentioned, it happens on both sides.
Well, during COVID, too, we relaxed a lot of the standards on methadone clinics. Instead of people having to come, you know, every 24 hours and et cetera, we relaxed some of that. And there was always had been that concern about methadone will be diverted, et cetera. But during COVID, we really didn't see that. We saw people actually getting methadone in a more timely and an easier fashion than in the past. So, you know, in some ways, COVID brought to light some of these issues.
Yeah. So what, all right, so let's say you're advising now the new drug czar. What's your recommendation?
Well, I think the opioid issue is one that's been dealt with pretty well, prescription drugs, from a host of ways. And I think the amount of diversion that is happening is for prescription pharmaceuticals is pretty minimal. I think the number of physicians that now have a lot of knowledge about pain, because when I met with physicians and said, well, how much training did you get in med school about pain treatment and addiction? And almost to a person, they'd say almost nothing. Very little information. But now you have places like Massachusetts, they, you know, a physician going through med school here has to have something like 3 days of curriculum for understanding addiction and that. So that's kind of behind us.
Yeah, I agree. My daughters just went through med school. I think on their first day of class, first year, they already got that memo. They're actually surprised that was even an issue in our days.
Right. I mean, when I spoke to physicians, you know, Dr. Hamburg from and others, and I was told, like, in med school, they said, look, as long as somebody has legitimate pain, you don't really have to worry. You can prescribe as much as you want. And dentists, of course, prescribing for 14 and 15 year olds that had wisdom teeth removed. I mean, when I was leaving the Seattle Police Department to take the job, the head of a federal law enforcement agency said, and this was 08, said, you know, I really want you to look at this prescription issue. It had, I don't think you could count on one hand the number of articles about prescription drugs. But he said, I have a son who should be a senior in high school, but he's a junior and he's in drug rehab because he had a football injury and was prescribed painkillers and became addicted to them. So we really spent a lot of time on the prescription drug issue. President Obama did the first national drug strategy on prescription drugs. But I think the fentanyl issue is one that's only going to be solved through prevention. I mean, we're still at, 107,000 fatalities a year. But I'm really proud of the fact that law enforcement is so much more engaged in getting people into treatment. I mean, they've become a gateway to help people.
It's amazing. Our law enforcement officer, when I see them bringing patients in the emergency department, they're like, you know, little, wouldn't be physician assistants, is it not the right word, but they're medically and mental health wise really aware and focused. I'm like, wow, I'm impressed. I don't think this is what you signed up to do, but good for you. So focus on fentanyl. What needs to happen on fentanyl?
I wish I had a good answer.
The magic wand.
The variety of the precursors and the legitimate use of some of these precursors. And as Scott Gottlieb said the other day, you know, I mean, even precursors, et cetera. I think the fact that we went through COVID and there was so many mental health issues about so many people, loneliness and on, but now we're kind of, you know, we're kind of getting our feet back in the community and looking out, you know, trying to look out more for each other. And I think that that's going to have an effect because we saw during COVID, we saw a real spike in crime. And now we're seeing some record lows across the country when it comes to crime. And maybe part of that is we're opening up back in the country.
I do like your overall message, though, and I definitely agree with you, is that we need to invest more in prevention. And if you look at, I like to look at history, to look at our successes. How did we end the opioid prescription epidemic? We didn't Suboxone our way or treat our way out of that. It was front end. It was like, we're going to have a next generation of Americans who, when they get their wisdom teeth taken out, don't say, oh, do I get Oxy now? We did it front end. And that's how it solved it. That's also how we decreased our tobacco. We didn't, you know, Nicorette gum our way out of the tobacco. We made it socially unacceptable to smoke. And that's how we did it. So I do think we invested a lot in naloxone, which is important because that's just life-saving. People drop dead and that should be around because of that problem. But we need now to really invest a lot more in prevention, prevent the next generation of Americans to go to any type of drug when life is hard. So I agree with you on that. With marijuana, so it is the most controversial. It was called the M word when I was at ONDCP. We weren't allowed to talk about it. I was allowed to say what my experience as a physician was with marijuana, but not policy. What should be the policies with marijuana?
So, I mean, the train left the station, I mean, pretty clearly. And if you go to a number of cities, the smell of marijuana just wafts through, you know, the downtown areas or by the nightclubs, et cetera. And as you know, it's a much more powerful. It comes in a lot of different forms, and including the vaping of marijuana. So I think that part of that is also the education. I mean, I have a grandson that just started his first semester of college and grew up in Colorado. And his mother's a teacher, our daughter's a teacher. And he I remember taking him to get haircuts when he was little, and there would be a marijuana store next to the barbershop, et cetera. And it fortunately, luckily, because of a lot of his wonderful family, supportive mother and father, it's never been a problem. But certainly other kids in his high school, other kids have run into that problem. If you don't have solid family structure, good communication, a supportive community, kids have really a difficult time right now.
But I also think that our society is being misled. We're told that it's healthy, it's just a plant, it's not a problem. Kind of like the days we're reliving history when you said, oh, well, nobody gets addicted to opioids if they have real pain. It's like, nobody has problems with marijuana unless they already have a tendency to have schizophrenia. That's just not true. I think that's why I like talking about marijuana, because there's so much misinformation that I don't want to tell people to use or not use, but you need to just know the facts.
Well, I think the work that Kevin Sabet has done and the smart approaches to marijuana, I mean, not just in the United States, but around the country. I mean, he's very strong on the facts and the research, and putting it in a very balanced way to say, look, this is not something that's going to be good for us or healthy for us. And as you know, if you're a young person and they use before the frontal cortex is completely formed and they use heavy amounts of marijuana, they're going to have the potential for lifelong problems. You know, if somebody's 30 years old and said, I want to smoke marijuana in my house on the weekend or something, there's not too many people that are going to say the police should be knocking down your door. But it's not recognizing that there is a danger to marijuana that I think is a mistake.
Yeah, that is smart. So did you work with Kevin Sabet when you were,
Kevin worked with me. He was at ONDCP
at the same time
when I went. I brought Kevin with me. Kevin came with me, and he had been there before on the Bush administration. I mean, he really, he's so knowledgeable. He's put together so many good practices, policies, and it's all fact-driven. It's all science. It's evidence-based. It's not anything except something that would lend itself to giving people valuable information about the problems of marijuana.
That's awesome. Shout out to Kevin and to Smart Approaches of Marijuana. And in the theme of, learning from history and in your wisdom and, again, it's a presidential election season. What's your advice? First 100 days at ONDCP, what needs to happen?
I'd like to see that the Office of National Drug Control Policy get a lot of attention in the first 100 days. That would send a strong message to all the new cabinet officials about being helpful and supportive of ONDCP.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. What a special treat to have you, learning so much from you. Historically balanced, right? This should not be a political issue. This is about the health of Americans, our safety, our children, our future.
I love it.
What a special treat to have this conversation with you.
Nice to meet you. Thanks for everything.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.